Sean!
Oliver.
Why the fuck did I invite you in here then to speak to me?
I'm not too sure, to be honest. I think I was the last reserve.
Yeah, you were. I had another guest that pulled out. But I brought you in here because we don't ever sit down as two people that speak to, I don't know, 300 people every month together, collectively. Some of those people might be at digital agencies. Some of them might be at influencer marketing agencies. Some might be at brands, ad agencies. Whatever they're at, if creativity and transformation is happening, we're speaking to them. Am I right?
You're right.
The thing is, when we host guests from the market here, and they give us brilliant sound bites and they tell us really interesting things, but we're not sharing what we're picking up from all of those different sources of information. And I think that's rather selfish, Sean.
I couldn't agree more.
Indeed.
I couldn't agree more, especially the things that you hear from you and me specifically with more very senior people that wouldn't be common knowledge to everyone.
Exactly.
And yes, there remains the anonymity, but you can still talk about the experiences that they share with you and all this, and it's, you know, some quite interesting stuff.
Indeed. And you're right, we will remain anonymous in this, and Absolutely. We'll do our best not to name drop people, because we are indeed a discreet, confidential talent consultancy. Where I want to go with this, so I framed it because I've just recently, I'm sure you know, just sent out my good CEO's newsletter.
Oh, I know. I'm fully subscribed.
Which, fantastic. Thank you. And I'm sure you've rehearsed all the things that I've sent your WhatsApp. But I thought they could make for quite a good framing of conversation.
I like that.
Because I was going to consider like going through all the things that people have reacted to on LinkedIn. And then I thought, actually, some of the stuff I write is a load of bollocks, and it's not been that engaging. So this, on the other hand, these are my 10 top hits.
That's a good idea.
So I think if you want to just be curious about what is in front of you, then perhaps that's how we should frame this conversation.
I like the sound of that.
And I might bounce some things back to you.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I think it'd be nice to do something like this, actually, because day to day we don't get a chance to all sit down and really reflect on, like, the topics that you've written here, yes, but like what's going well, what's not, and it doesn't happen enough.
Totally. It's a vacuum.
Yeah.
So without further ado.
Should we kick off with the topic one? I've got it on my screen now.
Oh, please do, Sean.
Firing clients is wonderful. Wow.
Okay, so this came from one of our good CEOs conversations. We had, you know, 12 to 15 CEOs in a room, and one of them represented an advertising agency. And this CEO was sitting there and going, I have a dilemma. The dilemma is we have too many clients. Cue laughter. But it was a genuine problem because the clients that they had accumulated had become executional from what is an agency that is revered for doing incredibly big creative campaigns. They had found themselves doing social posts for brands at really low margins. So the CEO turned around to the SLT and he said, I want to try something. I want to get all of our clients on a wall, all 30 of them, and I want all of you to use this framework to see which one we should fire, because after today, we're going to be firing a client. And they said, well, what's the criteria? Surely this is going to take us, like, we're going to have loads of different criteria. And he said, no. We're going to use what mother used back in the day, which is fun, fame, and fortune. The rule is the client has to score at least two of the Fs to remain a client. If it's one, we fire them. And you've got to think about that, because one of them could be fortune alone. But if it's not fun to work on, and if it's not going to create famous work which keeps the agency going and bigger clients coming to them, why are we working with them if it's just the money spinner? So they did, right? And the weird thing was, it wasn't a very good exercise to get rid of many clients, because 29 out of the 30 were either fun and fame, or fortune and fame, or fortune and fun, and some of them even scored all three.
Yeah.
But there was this one grisly-looking client in the corner where frustratingly, it scored one out of the three, and it was Fortune. But the account people on that, they'd gone through 20 account people in 3 years. They'd gone through all of the creative department. Nobody wanted to work on it. And if you got lumbered with it, it was almost, it felt like the agency was saying to you, we don't like you. You have to work on this terrible client because it's worth a lot of money to the business. So what they did is they turned around and they all agreed that they were going to fire that client. And that's why that's part of the story. The interesting part of the story is what happened then. Suddenly, people use this framework with what they were expecting to get out of a client. Because you'd get these creatives sitting on a campaign on a client, and they'd be saying, "Well, there's no fame to be had here." And someone would challenge, "Go, yeah, but we're having lots of fun. The client really gets us. We get along with them, and they're also paying us a lot of money. So that's the fortune and the fame. Sorry, that's the fortune and the fun." Mm. And so it was a really simplistic criteria to then go on with the agency. And the great end of the story is they pitched for a piece of business as famous as IKEA, I'll say, and they won it because they presented their own criteria and they said, "You're a 3 out of 3.
Wow.
How cool is that?
That is so cool.
So it's addition by subtraction.
Yeah.
It's you have to accept what you aren't going to do to then win more of what you want to do.
That's such an interesting exercise. I bet there's so much. Well, it'd be interesting to see if there's some bias in there from, because people's experience on different clients must be so different.
Yeah.
You know, like it's whether you're an account person, a designer, a creative, a strategist on that piece of work, everyone is going to feel different about it because what they do for that business is so different. You know, a creative's not seeing the work out there on the billboards that they expected to, they're not going to like it.
Mm.
Whereas a strategist, when you can see all the thinking that's gone behind that campaign in the real world, great, amazing client. So it's really, it's an interesting like human experiment as well.
Yeah.
What would be your criteria for firing or hiring a client of ours?
I would use the same criteria.
Yeah.
And I can say that quickly because some clients that don't pay us very much, they know that. And they come to us and they say, "Look, we're a company that are trying to grow. No one knows us. So there's the fame out of the window. However, there's potential fame. So the fortune might not happen, but there could be futuristic fortune. But the fame can happen because I would prefer to work with an agency or a brand that nobody knew about because then we can take the narrative to the market. So although there isn't immediate fame working with that VC, you know, just funded brand that's just won whatever, or agency that's just launched, you know that if you do a good job from a talent perspective, they will become hopefully famous, and as will your work with them. So I think it's bulletproof for any professional services business, whether it's recruitment, advertising, design, or whatever you do. So I would use the same criteria.
Of the three, which is your most important?
It doesn't work. It has to be a Venn diagram because we've taken clients that have been fortune alone.
Mm.
And we know how that feels. You have to make fun elsewhere to warrant the work on that client. So what you end up doing is you damage the culture of what your agency or business proclaims to stand for at the behest of a client that's paying you a load of money. Fun is obviously great. And how do you define fun? Mm-hmm. I think because we're in a commercially driven business, there has to be an element of fortune. Yeah. Otherwise, when we started Unknown, we did a lot of fun stuff.
Yeah.
And then it became quickly not very fun when we weren't making any money.
But we also tried to work with every single client under the sun.
Yeah.
And that became a problem.
Yeah.
You know, because it naturally our service dropped.
Yeah.
If we're being honest, I think there was a point probably 2 years ago when we were working with the best of the best branding agency, digital agency, creative agency, some amazing brands as well at that point. But it was too much and we sacrificed on our quality of service. So
1,000%. I think the learning from all of that, and I think you can apply it to any agency, is do you truly understand the client's objectives and which part you're playing in helping them achieve that. Because I think we would get tempted by a logo, and we would get tempted by, or a pound sign, right? There's the fortune and the fame again. And we wouldn't know, because of, I think, our line of inquisition back then, when it was like, oh, you want to work with us? Thank you, thank you, thank you. Our line of inquisition wasn't right. We were just saying, thanks for the briefs. Can we work them exclusively? And here's a bunch of people that we think are right. The difference now is, before we even get into talking about talent and whether or not you should even be hiring, we need to deeply understand the commercial objectivity here and which part you think we're going to be playing in that. Because so many, not just recruitment companies, creative agencies, rush to the solution before really understanding the question. And I think the thing that we've learned to work with fewer clients on a better basis is the secret to better is deep clarity of why we're even in this bed together. Otherwise, like any relationship, the relationship falls apart because you haven't worked out what are we trying to create together. There's that Daniel Sloss comedian that speaks about jigsaws. And he says his dad gave him this adage where he said, like, adage, never know what that word is. If you had, he said, why did your relationship work with mum so well? And he said, because we understood the jigsaws that we were building. The problem is most people in their relationships, as they go on and they find other couples, they get annoyed at each other that both of them aren't building the same jigsaw, but they never even show them the picture of what they were building in the first place. So I think the same thing applies to clients. I think you have to go, what are you trying to build? Are we the right partner to help you try and do that? And does your jigsaw look the same as what we're seeing here? Because I think we've got a dinosaur, we've got a T-Rex here, and you've got Downton Abbey. I don't know how that's going to work.
They don't fit.
They don't fit together. So yeah, I think we've evolved, and like the little things like that really, really help. Sean, what's on our second point here?
That's great. I could have dived even deeper into that, but I'm not going to.
No.
Because there are 10 points here.
Brace yourself.
Number two, the do's and don'ts replacing yourself as CEO with a managing director.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Indeed. So obviously we, you know, there's two things going on here for us. Number one, I've hired a managing director not to replace me as CEO, but to empower me as a CEO. And I'll come on to what that is and what the difference is there, because I think it's a big problem that a lot of people make. And the second thing is, lots of agencies come to us and brands come to us to say, can you help us hire a managing director because our CEO is either stepping away or we're firing them. So I wrote a little list of the do's and don'ts. And that's why I say I wrote a list. My good CEO's group, I came to them with the problem and said, I'm hiring a managing director. Every single one of you have been a managing director either to come in to replace another managing director or a managing director to replace a founder CEO. And we actually boiled down into three A's how you can make sure that the incoming hire is going to be successful. There were loads of do's and don'ts, like don't lie about the role, make sure that it's very clear, like do make sure you tell them what the commercial objectives are behind the role and that everybody is aligned with them. There were loads of those do's and don'ts, but where we landed on were the three A's. And that is ambition, alignment, and autonomy. Every company has an ambition. Every agency has an ambition. It's normally in a nice little cute line that they say it in, right? Not every agency, not every business has an aligned ambition. What I mean by that is, do the shareholders at the holding co agree with what the founder agrees with, what the CSO with the... Everybody has to be aligned on where we're heading and how we're measuring that thing. Because a candidate that's coming in to meet with a CEO will be convinced, but by the CEO, because he or she is the founder of that business or the CEO of that company and is setting the vision so they can sell the vision. But does everyone that's working here want to achieve that? And does the person that's invested in the company also want to achieve that? Because if I come in and I jump in and go, well, we're trying to do this. And then everyone go, well, no, we're not. Who said that? The CEO, fuck. So the first two things are really important. Ambition and alignment. And the third, autonomy. Loads of agencies and brands will hire somebody and give them an aligned ambition. And then they'll attach strings onto their hands and do this with them.
Yeah.
And they'll go, cool, you're in here now. You know, we said you're the CEO. Well, you are, kind of, by title. But we're going to tell you every single thing to do with your job every single day. God. So you can set a vision if we like it. And that is really disconcerting. And it's where every single call we end up getting from a CEO that wants to leave their job, or an ECD, or a creative director, or a designer. Hi, yeah, I was given a vision. It was a 2-year plan. I've come in. I've realized that nobody agrees with this vision. I also have figured out that they don't even want me to do the vision. They just want me to do what they want them to do. Mm-hmm. And I can't change anything here. I want to leave. And that's why. Ambition, alignment, and autonomy. So I wrote that, the do's and don'ts of replacing yourself with an MD. But I really wanted to say this is applicable to every hire that's out there.
Yeah. That was great.
Thanks, man.
I was like locked into that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, even though I've heard you talk about it before, I liked that.
Well, let's fucking move on.
100%.
What that means is that was boring. Can we get next one?
Oh, my God. Get me to question 3. What's Chuck Porter's 3-point how to run an agency?
Yeah.
That's written like a robot, by the way.
But... Yeah. What Chuck Porter? Yeah. ChatGPT did this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is really quick, and it's like, it's very 90s ad land. So Chuck Porter was the founder of Crispin Porter Bogusky.
Yeah.
In their heyday, 1990, 2000, like every piece of great work, every, you know, Super Bowl ad was probably being created by Crispin at some point. And Chuck Porter was a big brain behind a lot of that. And he has this really simplistic Venn diagram, but it's interesting to get into. The Venn diagram was, make good work, make sure everybody knows about it, and answer the phone. Do you know what I find interesting about that?
Mm.
A lot of agencies make good work. Some of it's not even real. And a lot of agencies can talk about that work, but a lot of them don't know how to. And you see that there's almost this bashfulness from creative agency, design agency, whatever people that kind of go, did some work, hee hee.
Yeah.
Do you like if you just said to them, break down exactly what you've done there and tell us about the results that's led to, the phone call would be ringing. The phone would be ringing a lot more. But I think people at agencies in particular are kind of embargoed from speaking about the work that they're creating. A lot of the time brands will say, we actually don't want you to tell anyone that was you. If that's the case, fair enough. Like, there's not a huge amount you can do. Perhaps you could do an anonymous thing and make it interesting and be like, we won't say who this is, but this really famous sports brand came to us with this problem.
Yeah, that's almost a creative idea in itself.
Yeah, but they don't. We say to agencies, like, say, boast about the stuff that you're doing and don't be so bashful about it, because I don't think in the world that we're in anymore, doing good work is enough.
Yeah, agreed.
Our eyeballs are everywhere. And I think you have to claim the work that you produced and give us the story behind it by putting out a beautiful brand design that you've done for a, you know, Series C funded business and just going, new workout or new work klaxon. Tell us what the problem was. Mm. Tell us how your expertise within that business has elevated that brand and has led to a round of applause, reinstalled love for the brand from the colleagues and the employees that work for the business, a drive in sales, download of the app, whatever it is.
Why don't marketing agencies, creative agencies, branding agencies talk about that stuff then?
I think it is a combination of two things. Probably client embargo and not wanting to piss the client off. You've just done some work for Nike. Nike are like, would you mind not shouting about that? Yeah. But the second thing is bashfulness and going, oh, I don't want to be one of those look at me people. But the problem is, I don't think you can exist anymore successfully by being infamous.
I get that. I wonder if it's from a ROI perspective. Mm. It's really hard to measure how much you get back from the story you put out. We find that with our content, right? Like, we bang the drum on write more consistently, like, you know, be an expert in your field, tone of voice is super important, keep talking, but it's hard to know what's working apart from some likes or some shares or some messages. And I wonder if it's a similar thing with these agencies, is we do the work, we get paid for it, and that's our reward.
Yeah.
It's not, but we're not going to talk about it because we don't get much back from that.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of don't consider the new business off the back of it, or the, or just the social proofing of an agency.
Yeah.
And also, they are a company full of, generally, storytellers, very, very, very good ones.
Yes.
So I'd be using that to my advantage and writing all the time if you had the time.
100%.
So I think that's could be the thing, is like,
I think you've wrapped that nicely. Because why isn't, you know, with what Chuck Porter was saying, everyone's making good, you make good work, make sure everyone knows about it. Why is nobody doing that? And I think you've made a valid point there, Sean.
Well, shall we move on?
We shall.
Okay. Sorry for my little giggle there. Number four is, why in-house offerings aren't just in-house agencies?
Indeed. So that's a weird one.
Why in-house offerings aren't in-house agencies? Yeah, so...
So, okay.
Yeah.
I get asked by nearly every single person that I meet, from CEO down to design director or whatever level, and I'm sure you do as well, and people say it like it's new, or they did say it like it's new, now it's kind of caught on. I'm thinking I might go in-house. Mm-hmm. And you go, of course you are, because this is really hectic, and you've just had a child, or you know, your autonomy is being ripped away, or shareholders are going, where the fuck's the money? I can understand. And you want to work with one brand and get deeper in it. I totally understand that. But the people that are successfully going in-house aren't looking at it like they are going into an in-house agency. They're going in it to understand how that business operates and the part that marketing, which by the way is never as big as you think, plays, or if they're building a product, how big that part plays. I think the thing that people really struggle with going in-house is how little work is made versus being at an agency. In an agency, you're almost spoiled for production. If you're not making, you're not making any money. Whereas a brand hasn't got the same level of pressure. And a creative person in particular goes into that and goes, why are we not constantly making? I've almost come from this place where I've had to do this the whole time. And the CMO or the chief of brand will turn around and say, well, because there's a lot more that we need to figure out before we go out and start shouting about what we're doing, or changing the product or rebranding or whatever it is. So I wrote in-house offerings on in-house agencies because I think there's a huge level of expectation that needs to be clear. The other point on this as well is everybody kind of wants to go to the logo.
Yeah.
And a really good product person will say, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, because I don't know your world as well as I know the other worlds, I want to go work at Airbnb. And I would look at that and go, okay, really strong functionality of that product. It's almost like not that. What is the impact that you're going to have as a product person for a really, really good product? Whereas if you told me that there was a really well-branded business that's fantastic at storytelling, almost like BA, I'm pissed off every time I go on BA because the advertising's phenomenal, Uncommon, brilliant. And it makes me go, yeah, I will fly BA. But that's rubbing off now. And I get the app and I go, why has it not picked up my tier point? Why does this never work? I've just gone to Nashville and I've had to literally call them up and go, can you just remember that? I'll put it on the system that I went to Nashville on a phone call. If I was a product person right now, I'd be running to BA going, this is really bad. This could be a lot better. This is where I can make an impact. So long answer to going in-house, go to the place where you see your value lacking, where you can make an impact.
Yeah.
If you're a great brand storyteller, I was about to say don't go to Nike, don't go to Apple. Maybe do, because they'll have some amazing things for you to do for them, but think where the stories aren't being told well. Where is there a phenomenal product but a terrible brand?
Mm.
There are so many of those out there. Where a storyteller can go, everyone should know about this. This is incredible. why does nobody know about this? And they'll be lit up because everyone will be looking at this person going, thank God you arrived. Whereas that person turns up at Apple and goes, hey, I think we should do Think Different again.
Exactly.
It's not the same.
It's that whole thing of, do you go somewhere where the foundations are already set,
yeah,
but you're going to the name, and that's apparently essential to your career, which I disagree with now, didn't used to.
Mm.
Or do you go somewhere that you build something that those foundations aren't even set yet, nothing's been made, but what you can do in 5 years and put your name on could be something that's groundbreaking. 100%. It's a whole risk. It is a risk in your career, like, yeah, because it can, I never say it will stall your career, because what you'll learn there is far greater than what you'd learn at a massive business like the ones we said. But I can see why there's friction to join them. And you were kind of talking about it then, about pressure.
Yeah.
And advertising agency environment, or sorry, just agency environment, being more pressure on designers, design directors, and so on. But I think that's changing too. I think there's becoming more and more pressure on when you're in a branding agency. In-house.
Yeah.
I think there's more pressure on designers moving in-house. The reason being is because, depending on the stage that business is at, let's say you're still in the funding stage or pre-IPO, you as a designer, you are so much closer to the investors, the stakeholders, and more importantly and actually quite scary, the CEO, the founder of the business, who is blood, sweat and tears over this thing. So the pressure that you have from that person than you would a CCO or your ECD is very different.
Yeah, and they're not going to talk to you in the same way that you've been spoken to. Like, this needs to change. They're not trained, or they haven't got the vocabulary of a CCO who goes, hey, great work, slugger. Like what you're trying to do there. Have you tried kerning the edges or changing this feature? Mm. You're just going to be like, this is shit. I like this. Change. And I think that's probably the most underrated thing, going into a brand and going into this, you know, behemoth thing that's badly branded or terrible product. How are you articulating to a human being that isn't from your world in what they need to understand to make their thing better? Because you both have an aligned purpose. Hopefully, if you go back to our second point, you both have an aligned ambition. But an aligned ambition isn't enough. And actually, the autonomy might even be there. But that person's still going to come to you when things aren't the way they saw it. Have you got the ability to vocabularize, if that's a word, where they need to change or accept that something isn't going to be how they imagine?
Yeah.
Because you can't... I think what we're saying is you can't just be fucking amazing at design.
Exactly.
You can't just be fucking amazing. Maybe you'll get away with that at Apple, where you are a rock star, right? But at most brands, with most incredible founders and CEOs that have built unicorn businesses, they haven't got the time or the patience to deal with your diva-isms and kind of, you know, my way or the highway.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually a really interesting point you make, is like communicating to the people that aren't from your world. I like that.
Yeah. It's a hard skill. But I think being a storyteller, no matter what you specialize in, is like essential when going in-house.
I love that. Sean, what's up next?
Yeah, it says 9 minutes.
Oh, time, well, we're getting good at this.
Yeah, we are. I'm enjoying this. I hope everyone else is.
Mum, if you're listening, won't be there for dinner on Sunday.
I'll be in Hollywood. Right, next point is, unsexy clients could lead to happier culture.
Indeed.
Ooh.
So this came from another good CEO's conversation, in that somebody was going, I feel like a small fish in a big pond, and I'm struggling to distinguish ourselves or differentiate ourselves in a very busy agency pool. And somebody said, what clients are you going after? And he said, well, you know, we're on lots of different shortlists, we're using these intermediaries. And he was like, cool, okay, so have you ever thought, just for like 6 months, going cold turkey on the sexy clients to appease your team? And he said, what do you mean? Well, his agency and his business started off as a social business, working with all the brands that you want to work with, all the fun ones, and the margins were dwindling and dwindling, until one day this property business called him up and went, I love what you're doing with Nike, let's say. Do you reckon you could do that for my property business? And he went, oh, fun, fame, fortune, blah. I mean, it's got fortune, maybe, but tell me about it. What do you want to do? And quite inspirationally, this guy just turns around and was like, well, you know, could you make us on social like the Nike of the property business? Now, that's a brief.
It's a cool brief.
It's a cool brief. But it wasn't sexy when it walked in the front door and everyone goes, oh, fuck me, not that. What they've ended up doing is now doubling down in that sector because it's the dustiest sector that is thirsty for distinctivity or distinctiveness. And so you've got these property businesses going, if only we weren't seen as a property business and we were seen more as a lifestyle brand, maybe more like a hotel chain like the Rosewood or whatever. Great. Now that's a brief. Mm. But that would never have come from that agency had they not have accepted where their value was going to be valued more. And it is. The margins aren't 12, 20, they're 40% margins. Mm. Because property companies make a lot of money and better branded property companies make even more. So what they've done is discover that the unsexy clients originally are far, and actually, it's not just financially they're sexier. The fame and the culture, the fun, that has come from working with someone that was, or a brand that was nothing, and taking them to something in their field, fair enough, not a household name, but in their world, you've made a whole bunch of people that work for that company proud.
Yeah.
That's fun. Mm. Client, thank you so much. That's fun.
Yeah.
So I think the 90s and like, you know, I want to show my mum that I've done this thing, and I think that's over. I think you can't just go after that.
I agree. I agree. And also being able to shout about a before and after that looks so different and so much better in so many ways is obviously more fun, and you get more satisfaction from that than if you were to change the smallest detail in a global behemoth brand.
Yes.
You know, it's so obvious, but yet it's so difficult not to get drawn back to the sexy logo.
Yes.
You know?
That's it, man. Yeah. That was my key point on that one.
Yeah, interesting. I liked that. Client services has a problem. They're order takers, not brief makers.
Whoa! Oh,
that's right.
Whoa.
Copyright that shit.
I sadly can't steal that because it wasn't my line. Okay. So it was actually a guy called Eric, who is a formidable CSO. We used to work at Crispin, funnily enough. And I spoke with him, and he went to an agency. I said I wasn't going to name drop, so I won't say his surname. He went to an agency that were one of the oldest advertising agencies in the world. Like we're talking J. Walter Thompson, but not. And it was his job to make this ad factory, like a Pez dispensing, well, here's your ad, like agency that were once revered. They were making all of the Super Bowl ads, just like we were saying about Crispin. Can you turn us into being a solutions-based business to our clients? Because currently, Pepsi are walking in and going, we've got this problem, and they'll go, here's the ad. And they were like, yeah, but I don't know if it's an ad. I'm not sure if it's an ad. And so he dug down and said, why is that happening? Because when Pepsi walked through the door, we should have somebody going, don't even tell me what you think the solution is right now. What is your business problem that we need to solve for you? And so the line, which I loved, that he came up with to the whole client services team was, you are no longer order takers. You are brief makers. And it sounds cheesy, and I'm sure it was used many times. We've had iterations of this. But the crux of what they're saying is listen, probe, think, diagnose before you prescribe. Mm. We're so, and I think, I feel for people in agency world, it's competitive. And we almost want to show that we're such fast thinkers that we know the solution straight away. But that can go against you so quickly. If you just take them at their word without probing any further, and you come back with a thing and they go, no, that is not what I was looking for. 9 times out of 10, it's because you didn't ask the right question. Yeah. Because you didn't delay the gratification of being right. You went, I've got the solution. I'm going to be arrogant and confident in my conviction. La, 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 la. I'm not going to ask you any more questions. Don't worry, I've got it. Rabbit out of the hat. What do you mean we're looking for a rabbit?
Yeah.
So I think the amazing bow on the end of that story is the agency then become, and I hate to use terms, away from an ad agency into being a strategic transformation studio. Those are words, right? Strategic transformation studio. What they're saying is, we will help you transform and get to where you're going by understanding what you're trying to achieve before we provide solutions, which may be an ad, may be a rebrand, may be nothing. It could be silence. Who knows? We won't know until we ask. So I like that. And that kind of, I think for client services people that are entering this world, people that started in this industry 5 years ago learned in their rooms. And they didn't sit next to people like this Eric Chapp, who would go, hold on, don't do that. You'd have people interrupting people on a Zoom call. So I think the osmosis learning that was meant to happen to those people, where everyone would sort of go, oh yeah, no, shut up, don't say anything. The cues weren't picked up. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, you've got this product of client services kids that are now getting into being senior account directors and GADs and all that sort of thing. And they've never been taught how to hold back and push for deeper analysis of a problem.
Yeah.
So that was that one.
Yeah, I think the negative impact that has on the person you're giving that brief to, you know, that designer or creative, is it creates so much more back and forth and time, and everything becomes slower. And you know, I've heard this actually quite a lot recently in digital agency world, where designers, amazing designers, are just getting essentially the order taker reading back to them the order. It's like, it's an order, do this, do that.
Yeah.
I don't know why, just do it. And then you go and do it, and then there's a problem and it's wrong. And it's so twisted.
I know.
I think because there are some amazing client services people that I know who they're so curious.
Mm.
Like, I think a key trait of an amazing client services person is curiosity to find out more about what that person in the team does, whether it's design, creative, copy, strategy, whatever it is, because then they understand their limits and what is achievable, what isn't. And then that then should give that person the confidence to push back with a client.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Anyway. Sean, that was wonderful. What a little bounce back and forth. Whilst you find the next thing, I'm going to look at the camera and...
Tell a joke. Took too long.
Okay.
Everyone is moving up the strategy ladder.
Indeed. This one we've wanged on about a lot, but...
You're talking about businesses.
Oh, yeah, good question. Up. I'm, to be honest, in this situation, I'm speaking about agencies, but I'm also speaking about businesses. I think every business is considering what their strategy is. If you look at Nike as an example, I would say they fell away from their strategy and the stock price reflects that. So strategy in itself is becoming more important. What I'm seeing, agencies that used to be more executional are having to become more strategically focused because, yes, AI, there's a mountain and the tide is rising up the mountain of capability. When I say, I mean AI capability. Mm. So if all the doing stuff that you were charging a high margin on is getting smaller and smaller, then the thinking stuff and the things that the robots can't do, like understand nuance, history, you know, connect the dots between what we see is going on in anthropological terms, that is where agencies, whatever their specialism was and is, are having to move towards. So if you're an influencer marketing agency, you were once selling access to influencers. You're not anymore. Why? Because TikTok can do that, and there are a bunch of other tools that can and can't do that to a varying degree. So what do? We sell the strategy that you're going to be using with your influencer marketing campaign, with creators and blah, 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 and here's how we see that, because our lens is wider than yours and wider than ChatGPT's. If you were a design agency in the 2000s, you were selling logos and you were selling colors and you were selling, you know, beliefs and stories. Now you're selling strategic direction for the business as well as all of that other stuff too. So you're moving from being a design agency into a strategic consultancy that, hey, may or may not do some logos for you too. The same thing's happening for ad agencies. I just mentioned that old agency that were making ads. They used to make great margins on the production. They used to charge for time. Now they're going, eesh, we can't charge for our time as well as we used to because capabilities are speeding up. And the clients are asking for us to do this for less, otherwise they'll go to that independent agency that will do that. So what do? We need to become more strategically able and capable to tell that client what they should be doing versus what they should be executing and making. So the agencies that we're seeing are now saying, we're not selling our effort, we're selling our value. And the only way an agency knows how to sell their value is by understanding deeply, strategically, what they're trying to achieve on behalf of their clients. So the reason I wrote that is because I feel like if you aren't considering how you can travel up the client tree in an advisory position, then you could be at risk of playing a zero-sum game in the race to the bottom, which is the margins game. And that exists across the entirety of the creative commercial agency landscape. So yeah, that's where that came from, Sean.
Love that, Ollie. I hired my number two by writing my least favourite things about my job.
When you say hired my number, I'm not going to make that joke. It was a crass joke. But when you said it, you paused on anyway.
I did.
You did, and it made me
comedic effect.
Laugh inside. Thank you, Sean. okay, this is easy. And I would recommend anybody who is in a C-level position that is trying to hire a deputy or a founder that's trying to replace themselves or hire a CEO, even if you're an ECD and you're stepping into a CCO position trying to find your replacement. What I did was I was finding that my time was going into things that I'm not very good at. Sometimes I'm competent at them, but the things that really drove me and really excited me and energized me, I was spending less and less time doing them. So I find that I'm better when I'm wondering and inventing and activating and, you know, trying things out. I'm not good at building systems, checking in on things, seeing if they're happening or not. My least favorite, the thing that will drain the life out of me, is if I've got to go back to someone to see if they've done a thing that we agreed they were going to do. So I was eye contacting you.
Yeah.
Where I got to was, this is really silly, because if I keep on doing stuff that I'm not very good at, this company won't evolve. So I'm just going to spend 5 minutes writing down all of the things that drain me about my job. Classically, things in that were things like operations, CRM, checking in on people to see if they've done the thing that they've done, people problems that take me away from meeting clients, coming up with new concepts, you know, whatever. And in that, I wrote a job spec. And you'll be unsurprised to hear it was called, the role, a people operations partner. She changed my life. Hannah, when she came into the business, took hold of all of those things. And the exciting thing was that she was excited about how she could develop that, because that would develop her career. She was now in charge of building operations and the CRM and the consistency and cadence of communication within the business. And I gave her full autonomy to do it. We were aligned. The ambition was clear-ish, I would say. But the autonomy was like, that's not my thing. And I don't want to be the person responsible for making a call on it anymore. And so she's still with us, hopefully going to be with us for a long time. And that only came out of the fact that I got sick and tired of doing a job that I wasn't very good at. So yeah, that's where that came from.
Keep coming back to those three A's as well.
It's annoying.
I love it.
Okay.
That's what this episode's going to be called.
Okay.
I'm conscious of time. Well, there's two more.
Let's get through them. I'll be quicker this time.
Thank God. You can run a global agency network with deep empathy and fierce commercials at the same time.
I'll do this in a sentence. We met a global president, CEO of a very, very well-networked big agency, and he came in and somebody said, how did you run that thing for 12 years so successfully? And he said, be on the numbers and give a fuck about everybody that works for you. And there's beautifully simple, like there was so much in that that we haven't got time to go into, but it reminded me that a network agency can be run to be commercially successful, not at the behest of its culture and people that work for them. It can't be easy, and I have no idea how this person did that, but everybody that worked with them seems to have had that experience and said, in the 12 years that we were at that business, we did the best we'd ever done commercially, and everyone had a fucking amazing time doing it. Next.
That's just a dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right.
Last one, Sean.
Yeah. Don't join a business with a vague succession plan Your objective needs to be crystallizing exactly what they mean.
I think I've covered this quite a lot. But the point I'd make on this is don't join a business that has a vague... Yeah. It was badly worded. That's gone out to 500 people. Great.
Great. Perfect.
And I spelled... I like checked that quite
well. Well, this goes out to two people.
Woo! Okay. Our mums. Yeah. And us four. hey, man, we're getting like 10,000 downloads.
Yeah,
on this episode,
more now. So, no, more.
Oh, it's more. Yeah, it's more. Anyway, don't join a business with a vague succession plan. Yeah, this is really important. You can bunch up in the leadership team if you haven't agreed where everyone's trying to get to. You can double up, as some people call it, Noah's Ark. Happens a lot with acquisitions when a company's acquired and you get twos of twos of twos. Yeah, the same thing happens with people that hire people in to solve their problems that they've not really agreed on what they are. But Sean, and you know what's coming, if the ambition is aligned and the autonomy is there, you shall not experience that problem.
Scene.
Cool. I've not really given you a chance here, Sean.
No, that's all right. I was more of the facilitator here.
Yeah, you were. But I just want to ask you anything about... sorry, not anything. I want to ask you one thing that you have noticed, that if you had a room full of newly funded founders that have perhaps just secured their Series C in funding their business, what would you like to tell them? There's 30 of them in this room. Hello, founders. Welcome to Sean's Glastonbury. What would you say to them? They're going, Sean, we've got these fucking amazing ideas and this thing. Ah, God, our product's not in a great place, but where do I start? Who do I hire? Ah, ah, ah.
Wow. Stop that.
Emotional founder.
Yeah, very emotional. It's a good question. I think a lot of people jump straight to growth and grow fast and will hire the right people, will hire some wrong people, but that's just what it will be. I think like that's the wrong mindset. I think it's all, you've always got to come back to why we're doing this in the first place. What's the mission statement? And probably less of the North Star goal that so many founders bang on about in a product. It's like, I heard this, it stuck with me from a few weeks ago with a pretty much exactly that person. I was sat down and we were talking through the hiring plans, the recent funding, and he said to me, just all like, I always want to be present and know what's happening, and the furthest I'm going to look is 3 months right now, because I can think about the wildly amazing goal that we've got in our heads that we want to become the best of this or the, you know, most successful in that industry. But unless we are nailing what the present and what is going on now, then that thing's inevitable.
Yeah.
So I think the advice is, funny coming from a recruitment agency, is don't just jump into hiring for the sake of hiring, because you'll get it wrong and you'll get burnt. We saw so many businesses bloat for the sake of it, and then it became a really difficult year ahead.
Yeah,
you know.
I think that's good advice.
So, yeah, I'd say that. And finally, I guess it's making sure that the people who are closest to you in that team, whether it's your leadership team, your investors, it's kind of more of the empowering, like leaning on the empowering thing, that the three A's that you talked about there, is as long as they've got those three A's and you are constantly close and realizing their value and respecting those people, the loyalty will remain, but also they'll feel part of this thing and that's bigger than just the day to day and the job. You know, I think like it's quite similar to what we have here at Unknown. Like, the ones who you have closest to, you know that it's, you have their loyalty, because we're all so open and over communicate all the time of what's working and what isn't working. And I think a lot of founders can be scared to do that with people that they've had for the first 5 years, and you're getting to that point where, you know, they've got some good equity they could probably cash out on, or the PRB's just come through, and it's like, you know. But I think as long as they're, for that to kind of avoid that from happening, it's just over communication, empowerment, and autonomy mainly.
Sean, that was stunning.
Mm.
And I couldn't agree with you more. I want to thank all of our 153 million thousand listeners. I've really enjoyed this.
Me too.
I'm glad we went long form. And we're going to put this out. It's going to be called What the Hell is Going On?
I'll be honest, I was completely unprepared for it.
You didn't look it.
They're arguably the most fun.
Indeed. To our listeners, thank you. And we'll be back.
Good night.